I don't care how you do it. I've trained you. You're experts at selling. Now show me how good you are. He was greeted by silence, and his employees glanced at one another. Alva Skerritt mopped his forehead. But they obeyed. The banner printed a picture of the Enright house, with the caption, "Is this the man you want to destroy?" A picture of Winan's home. "Match this if you can." A picture of Monadnock Valley. "Is this the man who has contributed nothing to society?" The banner ran Rourke's biography, under the byline of a writer nobody had ever heard of. It was written by Gail Winand. The banner ran a series on famous trials in which innocent men had been convicted by the majority prejudice of the moment. The banner ran articles on men martyred by society. Socrates, Galileo, Pasteur, the thinkers, the scientists. A long heroic line, each a man who stood alone, the man who defied men.
"But Gail, for God's sake, Gail, it was a housing project," wailed Alva Skerritt.
Winand looked at him helplessly.
"I suppose it's impossible to make you fools understand that that has nothing to do with it."
"All right. We'll talk about housing projects."
The banner ran an exposé of the housing racket. The graft, the incompetence, the structures erected at five times the cost a private builder would have needed, the settlements built and abandoned, the horrible performance, accepted, admired, forgiven, protected by the sacred cow of altruism. "Hell is said to be paved with good intentions," said the banner. "Could it be because we've never learned to distinguish what intentions constitute the good? Is it not time to learn? Never have there been so many good intentions so loudly proclaimed in the world. And look at it." The banner editorials were written by Gail Winand as he stood at a table in the composing room, written as always on a huge piece of print stock with a blue pencil, in letters an inch high. He slammed the GW at the end, and the famous initials had never carried such an air of reckless pride. Dominique had recovered and returned to their country house. Winand drove home late in the evening. He brought Rourke along as often as he could. They sat together in the living room with the windows open to the spring night. The dark stretches of the hill rolled gently down to the lake from under the walls of the house, and the lake glittered through the trees far below. They did not talk of the case or of the coming trial, but Winand spoke of his crusade, impersonally, almost as if it did not concern Rourke at all. Winand stood in the middle of the room, saying,
"All right, it was contemptible, the whole career of the banner, but this will vindicate everything. Dominique, I know you've never been able to understand why I felt no shame in my past, why I love the banner. Now you'll see the answer. Power. I hold a power I've never tested. Now you'll see the test. They'll think what I want them to think. They'll do as I say, because it is my city, and I do run things around here. Howard, by the time you come to trial, I'll have them all twisted in such a way there won't be a jury who'll dare convict you."
He could not sleep at night. He felt no desire to sleep.
"Go on to bed," he would say to Rourke and Dominique. "I'll come up in a few minutes."
Then Dominique from the bedroom, Rourke from the guest room across the hall, would hear Winan's steps pacing the terrace for hours, a kind of joyous restlessness in the sound, each step like a sentence anchored, a statement pounded into the floor. Once when Winand dismissed them, late at night, Rourke and Dominique went up the stairs together and stopped on the first landing. They heard the violent snap of a match in the living room below, a sound that carried the picture of a hand jerked recklessly, lighting the first of the cigarettes that would last till dawn, a small dot of fire crossing and recrossing the terrace to the pounding of steps. They looked down the stairs, and then looked at each other.
"It's horrible," said Dominique.
"It's great," said Rourke.
"He can't help you, no matter what he does."
"I know he can't. That's not the point."
"He's risking everything he has to save you. He doesn't know he'll lose me if you're saved."
"Dominique, which will be worse for him? To lose you, or to lose his crusade?" She nodded, understanding. He added, "You know that it's not me he wants to save.
I'm only the excuse.
She lifted her hand. She touched his cheekbone, a faint pressure of her fingertips. She could allow herself nothing else. She turned and went on to her bedroom, and heard him closing the guest room door.
"Is it not appropriate," wrote Lancelot Clokey in a syndicated article, "that Howard Rourke is being defended by the Winand papers? If anyone doubts the moral issues involved in this appalling case, here is the proof of what's what and who stands where. The Winand papers, that stronghold of yellow journalism, vulgarity, corruption, and muckraking, that organized insult to public taste and decency, that intellectual underworld ruled by a man who has less conception of principles than a cannibal, the Winand papers are the proper champions of Howard Rourke, and Howard Rourke is their rightful hero. After a lifetime devoted to blasting the integrity of the press, it is only fit that Gail Winand should now support a cruder fellow dynamiter."
"All this fancy talk going round," said Gus Webb in a public speech, "is a lot of bull. Here's the plain dope. That guy Winand salted away plenty, and I mean plenty, by skinning suckers in the real estate racket all these years. Does he like it when the government muscles in and shoves him out, so the little fellas can get a clean roof over their heads and a modern John for their kids? You bet your boots he don't like it, not one bit. It's a put-up job between the two of them, Winand and that red-headed boyfriend of his, and if you ask me, the boyfriend got a good hunk of cash out of Mr. Winand for pulling the job."
"We have it from an unimpeachable source," wrote a radical newspaper, "that Cortland was only the first step in a gigantic plot to blow up every housing project, every public power plant, post office, and schoolhouse in the USA. The conspiracy is headed by Gail Winand, as we can see, and by other bloated capitalists of his kind, including some of our biggest money bags. Too little attention has been paid to the feminine angle of this case," wrote Sally Brent in the New Frontiers. "The part played by Mrs. Gail Winand is certainly highly dubious, to say the least. Isn't it just the cutest coincidence that it was Mrs. Winand who just so conveniently sent the watchman away at just the right time, and that her husband is now raising the roof to defend Mr. Rourke? If we weren't blinded by a stupid, senseless, old-fashioned sense of gallantry where a so-called beautiful woman is concerned, we wouldn't allow that part of the case to be hushed up. If we weren't overawed by Mrs. Winand's social position and the so-called prestige of her husband, who's making an utter fool of himself, we'd ask a few questions about the story that she almost lost her life in the disaster. How do we know she did? Doctors can be bought just like anybody else, and Mr. Gail Winand is an expert in such matters. If we consider all this, we might well see the outlines of something that looks like a most revolting design for living."
"The position taken by the Winand press," wrote a quiet, conservative newspaper, "is inexplicable and disgraceful."
The circulation of the Banner dropped week by week, the speed accelerating in the descent, like an elevator out of control. Stickers and buttons inscribed, "We don't read Winand," grew on walls, subway posts, windshields, and coat lapels. Winand newsreels were booed off the theater screens. The Banner vanished from corner newsstands. The news vendors had to carry it, but they hid it under their counters and produced it grudgingly, only upon request. The ground had been prepared, the pillars eaten through long ago. The Cortland case provided the final impact. Rourke was almost forgotten in the storm of indignation against Gail Winand. The angriest protests came from Winand's own public, from the women's clubs, the ministers, the mothers, the small shopkeepers. Alva Skerritt had to be kept away from the room where hampers of letters to the editor were being filled each day. He started by reading the letters, and his friends on the staff undertook to prevent a repetition of the experience, fearing a stroke. The staff of the Banner worked in silence. There were no furtive glances, no whispered cuss words, no gossip in washrooms any longer. A few men resigned. The rest worked on, slowly, heavily, in the manner of men with life belts buckled, waiting for the inevitable. Gail Winand noticed a kind of lingering tempo in every action around him. When he entered the Banner building, his employees stopped at sight of him. When he nodded to them, their greeting came a second too late. When he walked on and turned, he found them staring after him. The "Yes, Mr. Winand," that had always answered his orders without a moment's cut between the last syllable of his voice and the first letter of the answer, now came late, and the pause had a tangible shape, so that the answer sounded like a sentence not followed, but preceded
by a question mark. One small voice kept silent about the Cortland case. Wynand had summoned Tui to his office the day after the explosion, and had said, "Listen, you, not a word in your column, understand? What you do or yell outside is none of my business, for the time being. But if you yell too much, I'll take care of you when this is over."
"Yes, Mr. Wynand.
As far as your column is concerned, you're deaf, dumb, and blind. You've never heard of any explosion. You've never heard of anyone named Rourke. You don't know what the word Cortland means. So long as you're in this building."
"Yes, Mr. Wynand."
"And don't let me see too much of you around here."
"Yes, Mr. Wynand."
Wynand's lawyer, an old friend who had served him for years, tried to stop him.
"Gale, what's the matter? You're acting like a child, like a green amateur. Pull yourself together, man."
"Shut up," said Wynand.
"Gale, you were the greatest newspaper man on earth. Do I have to tell you the obvious? An unpopular cause is a dangerous business for anyone. For a popular newspaper, it's suicide. If you don't shut your mouth, I'll send you packing and get myself another shyster."
Wynand began to argue about the case with the prominent men he met at business luncheons and dinners. He had never argued before on any subject. He had never pleaded. He had merely tossed final statements to respectful listeners. Now he found no listeners. He found an indifferent silence, half boredom, half resentment. The men who had gathered every word he cared to drop about the stock market, real estate, advertising, politics, had no interest in his opinion on art, greatness, and abstract justice. He heard a few answers. "Yes, Gale, yes, sure. But on the other hand, I think it was damn selfish of the man. And that's the trouble with the world today, selfishness. Too much selfishness everywhere. That's what Lancelot Clokey said in his book. Swell book, all about his childhood. You read it. Saw your picture with Clokey. Clokey's been all over the world. He knows what he's talking about." "Yes, Gale, but aren't you kind of old-fashioned about it? What's all that great man stuff? What's great about a glorified bricklayer? Who's great, anyway? We're all just a lot of glands and chemicals and whatever we ate for breakfast. I think Lois Cook explained it very well in that beautiful little... what's its name? Yes, The Gallant Gallstone. Yes, sir. Your own banner plugged like blazes for that little book." "But look, Gale, he should have thought of other people before he thought of himself. I think if a man's got no love in his heart, he can't be much good. I heard that in a play last night. That was a grand play. The new one by Ike... what the hell's his last name? You ought to see it. Your own Jules Fogler said it's a brave and tender stage poem." "You make out a good case, Gale, and I wouldn't know what to say against it. I don't know where you're wrong, but it doesn't sound right to me. Because Ellsworth Tui... now, don't misunderstand me. I don't agree with Tui's political views at all. I know he's a radical. But on the other hand, you've got to admit that he's a great idealist with a heart as big as a house. Well, Ellsworth Tui said..." These were the millionaires, the bankers, the industrialists, the businessmen, who could not understand why the world was going to hell, as they moaned in all their luncheon speeches. One morning, when Wynand stepped out of his car in front of the Banner building, a woman rushed up to him as he crossed the sidewalk. She had been waiting by the entrance. She was fat and middle-aged. She wore a filthy cotton dress and a crushed hat. She had a pasty, sagging face, a shapeless mouth, and black, round, brilliant eyes. She stood before Gale Wynand, and she flung a bunch of rotted beet leaves at his face. There were no beets, just the leaves, soft and slimy, tied with a string. They hit his cheek and rolled down to the sidewalk. Wynand stood still. He looked at the woman. He saw the white flesh, the mouth hanging open in triumph, the face of self-righteous evil. Passers-by had seized the woman, and she was screaming unspeakable obscenities. Wynand raised his hand, shook his head, gesturing for them to let the creature go, and walked into the Banner building, a smear of greenish-yellow across his cheek.
"Ellsworth, what are we going to do?" moaned Alva Skerritt. "What are we going to do?"
Ellsworth Tui sat perched on the edge of his desk, and smiled, as if he wished he could kiss Alva Skerritt.
"Why don't they drop the damn thing, Ellsworth? Why doesn't something break to take it off the front pages? Couldn't we scare up an international situation or something?
In all my born days, I've never seen people go so wild over so little. A dynamiting job. Christ, Ellsworth, it's a back-page story. We get them every month, practically with every strike. Remember the furrier's strike, the dry-cleaner's strike? Oh, what the hell? Why all this fury? Who cares? Why do they care?
There are occasions, Alva, when the issues at stake are not the ostensible facts at all, and the public reaction seems out of all proportion, but isn't. You shouldn't be so glum about it. I'm surprised at you. You should be thanking your stars. You see, this is what I meant by waiting for the right moment. The right moment always comes. Damned if I expected it to be handed to me on a platter like that, though. Cheer up, Alva. This is where we take over.
Take over what?
The Winand papers.
You're crazy, Ellsworth. Like all of them, you're crazy. What do you mean? Gale holds 51% of...
Alva, I love you. You're wonderful, Alva, I love you, but I wish to God you weren't such a goddamn fool so I could talk to you. I wish I could talk to somebody.
Ellsworth Toohey tried to talk to Gus Webb one evening, but it was disappointing. Gus Webb drawled,
"Trouble with you, Ellsworth, is you're too romantic, too goddamn metaphysical. What's all the gloating about? There's no practical value to the thing. Nothing to get your teeth into, except for a week or two. I wish he'd blasted it when it was full of people. A few children blown to pieces, then you'd have something. Then I'd love it. The movement could use it. But this, hell, they'll send the fool to the clink, and that's that. You, a realist? You're an incurable specimen of the intelligentsia, Ellsworth. That's all you are. You think you're a man of the future? Don't kid yourself, sweetheart. I am."
Toohey sighed.
"You're right, Gus," he said.
Chapter 14.
"It's kind of you, Mr. Toohey," said Mrs. Keating humbly. "I'm glad you came. I don't know what to do with Petey. He won't see anyone. He won't go to his office. I'm scared, Mr. Toohey. Forgive me, I mustn't whine. Maybe you can help. Pull him out of it. He thinks so much of you, Mr. Toohey."
"Yes, I'm sure. Where is he?"
"Right here, in his room. This way, Mr. Toohey."
The visit was unexpected. Toohey had not been here for years. Mrs. Keating felt very grateful. She led the way down the hall and opened a door without knocking, afraid to announce the visitor, afraid of her son's refusal. She said brightly,
"Look, Petey, look what a guest I have for you."
Keating lifted his head. He sat at a littered table, bent under a squat lamp that gave a poor light. He was doing a crossword puzzle torn out of a newspaper. There was a tall glass on the table, with a dried red rim that had been tomato juice, a box containing a jigsaw puzzle, a deck of cards, a Bible. "Hello, Ellsworth," he said, smiling. He leaned forward to rise, but forgot the effort halfway. Mrs. Keating saw the smile and stepped out hastily, relieved, closing the door. The smile went, not quite completed. It had been an instinct of memory. Then he remembered many things which he had tried not to understand. "Hello, Ellsworth," he repeated helplessly. Toohey stood before him, examining the room, the table, with curiosity.
"Touching, Peter," he said.
"Very touching. I'm sure he'd appreciate it if he saw it." "Who?"
"Not very talkative these days, are you, Peter? Not very sociable."
"I wanted to see you, Ellsworth. I wanted to talk to you." Toohey grasped a chair by the back, swung it through the air in a broad circle like a flourish, planted it by the table, and sat down.
"Well, that's what I came here for," he said.
"To hear you talk." Keating said nothing.
"Well?"
"You mustn't think I didn't want to see you, Ellsworth. It was only... what I told Mother about not letting anyone in. It was on account of the newspaper people. They won't leave me alone."
"My, how times change, Peter. I remember when one couldn't keep you away from newspaper people."
"Ellsworth, I haven't any sense of humor left. Not any at all."
"That's lucky, or you'd die laughing."
"I'm so tired, Ellsworth. I'm glad you came."
The light glanced off Tui's glasses, and Keating could not see his eyes, only two circles filled with a metallic smear, like the dead headlights of a car reflecting the approach of something from a distance.
"Think you can get away with it?" asked Tui.
"With what?"
"The Hermit Act, the Great Penance,
the Loyal Silence." "Ellsworth, what's the matter with you?"
"So he's not guilty, is he? So you want us to please leave him alone, do you?"
Keating's shoulders moved. More an intention than the reality of sitting up straight, but still an intention. And his jaw moved enough to ask, "What do you want?"
"The whole story."
"What for?"
"Want me to make it easier for you? Want a good excuse, Peter?" "I could, you know. I could give you 33 reasons, all noble, and you'd swallow any one of them. But I don't feel like making it easier for you. So I'll just tell you the truth."
"To send him to the penitentiary. Your hero, your idol, your generous friend, your guardian angel." "I have nothing to tell you, Ellsworth."
"While you're being shocked out of the last of your wits, you'd better hang on to enough to realize that you're no match for me. You'll talk if I want you to talk, and I don't feel like wasting time. Who designed Cortland?"
"I did."
"Do you know that I'm an architectural expert?"
"I designed Cortland."
"Like the Cosmos Slotnick building?"
"What do you want from me?"
"I want you on the witness stand, Petey. I want you to tell the story in court. Your friend isn't as obvious as you are. I don't know what he's up to. That remaining at the scene was a bit too smart. He knew he'd be suspected, and he's playing it subtle. God knows what he intends to say in court. I don't intend to let him get away with it." "The motive is what they're all stuck on. I know the motive. Nobody will believe me if I try to explain it, but you'll state it under oath. You'll tell the truth. You'll tell them who designed Cortland and why."
"I designed it."
"If you want to say that on the stand, you'd better do something about your muscular control. What are you shaking for?"
"Leave me alone."
"Too late, Petey."
"Ever read Faust?"
"What do you want?" "Howard Rourke's neck."
"He's not my friend. He's never been. You know what I think of him?"
"I know, you goddamn fool. I know you've worshipped him all your life. You've knelt and worshipped while stabbing him in the back. You didn't even have the courage of your own malice. You couldn't go one way or the other. You hated me. Oh, don't you suppose I knew it? And you followed me. You loved him, and you've destroyed him. Oh, you've destroyed him, all right, Petey, and now there's no place to run. And you'll have to go through with it."
"What's he to you?"
"What difference does it make to you?" "You should have asked that long ago. But you didn't. Which means that you knew it. You've always known it. That's what's making you shake. Why should I help you lie to yourself? I've done that for 10 years. That's what you came to me for. That's what they all come to me for. But you can't get something for nothing. Ever. My socialistic theories to the contrary, notwithstanding. You got what you wanted from me. It's my turn now."
"I won't talk about Howard. You can't make me talk about Howard."
"No? Why don't you throw me out of here? Why don't you take me by the throat and choke me? You're much stronger than I am." "But you won't. You can't." "Do you see the nature of power, Petey? Physical power? Muscle or guns or money? You and Gail Winand should get together. You have a lot to tell him. Come on, Peter. Who designed Cortland?"
"Leave me alone."
"Who designed Cortland?"
"Let me go."
"Who designed Cortland?"
"It's worse."
"What you're doing?" "It's much worse." "Than what?"
"Than what I did to Lucius Heyer."
"What did you do to Lucius Heyer?"
"I killed him."
"What are you talking about?"
"That's why it was better. Because I let him die."
"Stop raving."
"Why do you want to kill Howard?"
"I don't want to kill him. I want him in jail. You understand? In jail. In a cell behind bars. Locked, stopped, strapped. And alive. He'll get up when they tell him to. He'll eat what they give him.
He'll move when he's told to move, and stop when he's told. He'll walk to the jute mill when he's told, and he'll work as he's told. They'll push him if he doesn't move fast enough, and they'll slap his face when they feel like it, and they'll beat him with rubber hose if he doesn't obey. And he'll obey. He'll take orders. He'll take orders.
Ellsworth, Keating screamed.
Ellsworth! You make me sick. Can't you take the truth? No, you want your sugarcoating. That's why I prefer Gus Webb. There's one who has no illusions.
Mrs. Keating threw the door open. She had heard the scream.
Get out of here,
Toohey snapped at her. She backed out, and Toohey slammed the door. Keating raised his head. You have no right to talk to Mother that way. She had nothing to do with you.
Who designed Cortland?
Keating got up. He dragged his feet to a dresser, opened a drawer, took out a crumpled piece of paper and handed it to Toohey. It was his contract with Rourke. Toohey read it and chuckled once, a dry snap of sound. Then he looked at Keating.
You're a complete success, Peter, as far as I'm concerned. But at times I have to want to turn away from the sight of my successes.
Keating stood by the dresser, his shoulders slumped, his eyes empty.
I didn't expect you to have it in writing like that, with his signature.
So that's what he's done for you.
And this is what you do in return.
No, I take back the insults, Peter. You had to do it. Who are you to reverse the laws of history?
Do you know what this paper is?
The impossible perfect. The dream of the centuries. The aim of all of mankind's great schools of thought. You harnessed him. You made him work for you. You took his achievement, his reward, his money, his glory, his name. We only thought and wrote about it. You gave a practical demonstration. Every philosopher from Plato up should thank you. Here it is, the philosopher's stone, for turning gold into lead.
I should be pleased. But I guess I'm human and I can't help it. I'm not pleased. I'm just sick. The others, Plato and all the rest, they really thought it would turn lead into gold. I knew the truth from the first. I've been honest with myself, Peter, and that's the hardest form of honesty. The one you all run from at any price. And right now I don't blame you. It is the hardest one, Peter.
He sat down wearily and held the paper by the corners in both hands. He said,
If you want to know how hard it is, I'll tell you. Right now I want to burn this paper. Make what you wish of that. I don't claim too great a credit, because I know that tomorrow I'll send this to the district attorney. Rourke will never know it, and it would make no difference to him if he knew. But in the truth of things, there was one moment when I wanted to burn this paper.
He folded the paper cautiously and slipped it into his pocket. Keating followed his gestures, moving his whole head, like a kitten watching a ball on a string.
You make me sick, said Toohey. God, how you make me sick! Oh, you hypocritical sentimentalists! You go along with me, you spout what I teach you, you profit by it, but you haven't the grace to admit to yourself what you're doing. You turn green when you see the truth. I suppose that's in the nature of your natures, and that's precisely my chief weapon, but God, I get tired of it. I must allow myself a moment free of you. That's what I have to put on an act for all my life. For mean little mediocrities like you. To protect your sensibilities, your posturings, your conscience, and the peace of the mind you haven't got, that's the price I pay for what I want, but at least I know that I've got to pay it. And I have no illusions about the price or the purchase.
What do you want, Ellsworth?
Power, Petey.
There were steps in the apartment above, someone skipping gaily. A few sounds on the ceiling, as of 4 or 5 tap beats. The light fixture jingled, and Keating's head moved up in obedience. Then it came back to Toohey. Toohey was smiling, almost indifferently.
You always said, Keating began thickly, and stopped. I've always said just that.
clearly, precisely, and openly. It's not my fault if you couldn't hear. You could, of course. You didn't want to, which was safer than deafness. For me. I said I intended to rule, like all my spiritual predecessors, but I'm luckier than they were. I inherited the fruit of their efforts, and I shall be the one who'll see the great dream made real. I see it all around me today. I recognize it. I don't like it. I didn't expect to like it. Enjoyment is not my destiny. I shall find such satisfaction as my capacity permits. I shall rule.
Whom?
You. The world. It's only a matter of discovering the lever. If you learn how to rule one single man's soul, you can get the rest of mankind. It's the soul, Peter, the soul. Not whips or swords or fire or guns. That's why the Caesars, the Attilas, the Napoleons were fools and did not last.
We will.
The soul, Peter, is that which can't be ruled. It must be broken. Drive a wedge in, get your fingers on it, and the man is yours. You won't need a whip, he'll bring it to you and ask to be whipped. Set him in reverse, and his own mechanism will do your work for you. Use him against himself. Want to know how it's done? See if I ever lied to you. See if you haven't heard all this for years but didn't want to hear, and the fault is yours, not mine. There are many ways. Here's one. Make man feel small. Make him feel guilty. Kill his aspiration and his integrity. That's difficult. The worst among you gropes for an ideal in his own twisted way. Kill integrity by internal corruption. Use it against itself. Direct it toward a goal destructive of all integrity. Preach selflessness. Tell man that he must live for others. Tell men that altruism is the ideal. Not a single one of them has ever achieved it, and not a single one ever will. His every living instinct screams against it. But don't you see what you accomplish? Man realizes that he's incapable of what he's accepted as the noblest virtue, and it gives him a sense of guilt, of sin, of his own basic unworthiness. Since the supreme ideal is beyond his grasp, he gives up eventually all ideals, all aspiration, all sense of his personal value. He feels himself obliged to preach what he can't practice, but one can't be good halfway, or honest approximately. To preserve one's integrity is a hard battle. Why preserve that which one knows to be corrupt already? His soul gives up its self-respect. You've got him. He'll obey. He'll be glad to obey because he can't trust himself. He feels uncertain. He feels unclean. That's one way. Here's another. Kill man's sense of values. Kill his capacity to recognize greatness or to achieve it. Great men can't be ruled. We don't want any great men. Don't deny the conception of greatness. Destroy it from within. The great is the rare, the difficult, the exceptional. Set up standards of achievement open to all, to the least, to the most inept, and you stop the impetus to effort in all men, great or small. You stop all incentive to improvement, to excellence, to perfection. Laugh at Rourke and hold Peter Keating as a great architect. You've destroyed architecture. Build up Lois Cook, and you've destroyed literature. Hail Ike, and you've destroyed the theater. Glorify Lancelot Clokey, and you've destroyed the press. Don't set out to raise all shrines. You'll frighten men. Enshrine mediocrity, and the shrines are raised. Then there's another way. Kill by laughter. Laughter is an instrument of human joy. Learn to use it as a weapon of destruction. Turn it into a sneer. It's simple. Tell them to laugh at everything. Tell them that a sense of humor is an unlimited virtue. Don't let anything remain sacred in a man's soul, and his soul won't be sacred to him. Kill reverence, and you've killed the hero in man. One doesn't reverence with a giggle. He'll obey, and he'll set no limits to his obedience. Anything goes. Nothing is too serious. Here's another way. This is most important. Don't allow men to be happy. Happiness is self-contained and self-sufficient. Happy men have no time and no use for you. Happy men are free men. So, kill their joy in living. Take away from them whatever is dear or important to them. Never let them have what they want. Make them feel that the mere fact of a personal desire is evil. Bring them to a state where saying, I want, is no longer a natural right, but a shameful admission. Altruism is of great help in this. Unhappy men will come to you. They'll need you. They'll come for consolation, for support, for escape. Nature allows no vacuum. empty man's soul, and the space is yours to fill. I don't see why you should look so shocked, Peter. This is the oldest one of all. Look back at history. Look at any great system of ethics from the Orient up. Didn't they all preach the sacrifice of personal joy? Under all the complications of verbiage, haven't they all had a single leitmotif? Sacrifice? Renunciation? Self-denial? Haven't you been able to catch their theme song? Give up, give up, give up, give up. Look at the moral atmosphere of today. Everything enjoyable, from cigarettes to sex to ambition to the profit motive, is considered depraved or sinful. Just prove that a thing makes men happy, and you've damned it. That's how far we've come. We've tied happiness to guilt. And we've got mankind by the throat. Throw your firstborn into a sacrificial furnace, lie on a bed of nails, go into the desert to mortify the flesh. Don't dance. Don't go to the movies on Sunday. Don't try to get rich. Don't smoke. Don't drink. It's all the same line, the great line. Fools think that taboos of this nature are just nonsense, something left over, old-fashioned. But there's always a purpose in nonsense. Don't bother to examine a folly. Ask yourself only what it accomplishes. Every system of ethics that preached sacrifice grew into a world power and ruled millions of men. Of course, you must dress it up. You must tell people that they'll achieve a superior kind of happiness by giving up everything that makes them happy. You don't have to be too clear about it. Use big, vague words. Universal harmony. Eternal spirit. Divine purpose. Nirvana. Paradise. Racial supremacy. The dictatorship of the proletariat. Internal corruption, Peter. That's the oldest one of all. The farce has been going on for centuries and men still fall for it. Yet the test should be so simple. Just listen to any prophet, and if you hear him speak of sacrifice, run. Run faster than from a plague. It stands to reason that where there's sacrifice, there's someone collecting sacrificial offerings. Where there's service, there's someone being served. The man who speaks to you of sacrifice speaks of slaves and masters, and intends to be the master. But if ever you hear a man telling you that you must be happy, that it's your natural right, that your first duty is to yourself, that will be the man who's not after your soul. That will be the man who has nothing to gain from you. But let him come, and you'll scream your empty heads off, howling that he's a selfish monster. So the racket is safe for many, many centuries. But here you might have noticed something. I said, it stands to reason. Do you see? Men have a weapon against you. Reason. So you must be very sure to take it away from them. Cut the props from under it. But be careful. Don't deny outright. Never deny anything outright. You give your hand away. Don't say reason is evil, though some have gone that far and with astonishing success. Just say that reason is limited. That there's something about it. What? You don't have to be too clear about it either. The field's inexhaustible. Instinct, feeling, revelation, divine intuition, dialectic materialism. If you get caught at some crucial point and somebody tells you that your doctrine doesn't make sense, you're ready for him. You tell him that there's something above sense, that here he must not try to think. He must feel. He must believe. Suspend reason, and you play it deuces wild. Anything goes in any manner you wish whenever you need it. You've got him. Can you rule a thinking man? We don't want any thinking men. Keating had sat down on the floor by the side of the dresser. He had felt tired, and he had simply folded his legs. He did not want to abandon the dresser. He felt safer leaning against it, as if it still guarded the letter he had surrendered. Peter, you've heard all this. You've seen me practicing it for 10 years. You see it being practiced all over the world. Why are you disgusted? You have no right to sit there and stare at me with the virtuous superiority of being shocked. You're in on it. You've taken your share, and you've got to go along. You're afraid to see where it's leading. I'm not. I'll tell you. The world of the future. The world I want. A world of obedience and of unity. A world where the thought of each man will not be his own, but an attempt to guess the thought in the brain of his neighbor, who'll have no thought of his own but an attempt to guess the thought of the next neighbor, who'll have no thought, and so on, Peter, around the globe. since all must agree with all. A world where no man will hold a desire for himself, but will direct all his efforts to satisfy the desires of his neighbor, who will have no desires except to satisfy the desires of the next neighbor, who will have no desires. Around the globe, Peter, since all must serve all. A world in which man will not work for so innocent an incentive as money, but for that headless monster, prestige, the approval of his fellows, their good opinion, the opinion of men who'll be allowed to hold no opinion, an octopus, all tentacles and no brain. Judgment, Peter. Not judgment, but public polls, an average drawn upon zeros, since no individuality will be permitted, a world with its motor cut off, and a single heart pumped by hand. My hand. And the hands of a few, a very few other men like me, those who know what makes you tick, you great, wonderful average, you who have not risen in fury when we called you the average, the little, the common, you who've liked and accepted those names, you'll sit enthroned and enshrined, you, the little people, the absolute ruler to make all past rulers squirm with envy, the absolute, the unlimited God and prophet and king combined. Vox populi. The average, the common, the general. Do you know the proper antonym for ego? Bromide, Peter. The rule of the bromide. But even the trite has to be originated by someone at some time. We'll do the originating. Vox Dei. We'll enjoy unlimited submission from men who've learned nothing except to submit. We'll call it to serve. We'll give out medals for service. You'll fall over one another in a scramble to see who can submit better and more. There will be no other distinction to seek, no other form of personal achievement. Can you see Howard Rourke in the picture? No? Then don't waste time on foolish questions. Everything that can't be ruled must go. And if freaks persist in being born occasionally, they will not survive beyond their 12th year, when their brain begins to function. It will feel the pressure, and it will explode. The pressure gauged to a vacuum. Do you know the fate of deep-sea creatures brought out to sunlight? So much for future Rorks. The rest of you will smile and obey. Have you noticed that the imbecile always smiles? Man's first frown is the first touch of God on his forehead, the touch of thought. But we'll have neither God nor thought, only voting by smiles, automatic levers, all saying, yes. Now, if you were a little more intelligent, like your ex-wife, for instance, you'd ask, what of us, the rulers? What of me, Ellsworth Monckton Toohey? And I'd say, yes, you're right. I'll achieve no more than you will. I'll have no purpose save to keep you contented, to lie, to flatter you, to praise you, to inflate your vanity, to make speeches about the people and the common good. Peter, my poor old friend, I'm the most selfless man you've ever known. I have less independence than you, whom I just forced to sell your soul. You've used people at least for the sake of what you could get from them for yourself. I want nothing for myself. I use people for the sake of what I can do to them. It's my only function and satisfaction. I have no private purpose. I want power. I want my world of the future. Let all live for all. Let all sacrifice and none profit. Let all suffer and none enjoy. Let progress stop. Let all stagnate. There's a quality in stagnation, all subjugated to the will of all, universal slavery, without even the dignity of a master. Slavery to slavery. A great circle, and a total equality. The world of the future. Ellsworth, you're insane? Afraid to say it? There you sit, and the words written all over you, your last hope. Insane? Look around you. Pick up any newspaper and read the headlines. Isn't it coming? Isn't it here? Every single thing I told you is in Europe swallowed already, and we're stumbling on to follow. Everything I said is contained in a single word, collectivism. And isn't that the God of our century? To act together, to think, together, to feel, together,
to unite, to agree, to obey. To obey, to serve, to sacrifice. Divide and conquer, first, but then, unite and rule.
We've discovered that one at last.
Remember the Roman emperor who said he wished humanity had a single neck so he could cut it. People have laughed at him for centuries, but we'll have the last laugh. We've accomplished what he couldn't accomplish. We've taught men to unite. This makes one neck ready for one leash. We found the magic word. Collectivism. Look at Europe, you fool. Can't you see past the guff and recognize the essence? One country dedicated to the proposition that man has no rights, that the collective is all, the individual held as evil, the mass as God, no motive and no virtue permitted, except that of service to the proletariat. That's one version. Here's another. A country dedicated to the proposition that man has no rights, that the state is all, the individual held as evil, the race as God, no motive and no virtue permitted, except that of service to the race. Am I raving? Or is this the cold reality of two continents already? Watch the pincer movement. If you're sick of one version, we'll push you into the other. We get you coming and going. We've closed the doors. We've fixed the coin. Heads, collectivism, and tails, collectivism. Fight the doctrine which slaughters the individual with a doctrine which slaughters the individual. Give up your soul to a council, or give it up to a leader, but give it up. Give it up. Give it up. My technique, Peter. Offer poison as food, and poison as antidote. Go fancy on the trimmings, but hang on to the main objective. Give the fools a choice. Let them have their fun. But don't forget the only purpose you have to accomplish. Kill the individual. Kill man's soul. The rest will follow automatically. Observe the state of the world as of the present moment. Do you still think I'm crazy, Peter?
Keating sat on the floor, his legs spread out. He lifted one hand and studied his fingertips, then put it to his mouth and bit off a hangnail. But the movement was deceptive. The man was reduced to a single sense, the sense of hearing, and Tui knew that no answer could be expected. Keating waited obediently. It seemed to make no difference. The sounds had stopped, and it was now his function to wait until they started again. Tui put his hands on the arms of his chair, then lifted his palms from the wrists, and clasped the wood again. A little slap of resigned finality. He pushed himself up to his feet.
"Thank you, Peter," he said gravely. "Honesty is a hard thing to eradicate. I've made speeches to large audiences all my life. This was the speech I'll never have a chance to make."
Keating lifted his head. His voice had the quality of a down payment on terror. It was not frightened, but it held the advance echoes of the next hour to come.
"Don't go, Ellsworth."
Tui stood over him and laughed softly.
"That's the answer, Peter. That's my proof. You know me for what I am. You know what I've done to you. You have no illusions of virtue left. But you can't leave me. And you'll never be able to leave me. You've obeyed me in the name of ideals. You'll go on obeying me without ideals. Because that's all you're good for now. Good night, Peter."
Chapter 15. This is a test case. What we think of it will determine what we are. In the person of Howard Rourke, we must crush the forces of selfishness and antisocial individualism, the curse of our modern world, here shown to us in ultimate consequences. As mentioned at the beginning of this column, the district attorney now has in his possession a piece of evidence, we cannot disclose its nature at this moment, which proves conclusively that Rourke is guilty. We, the people, shall now demand justice. This appeared in one small voice on a morning late in May. Gail Winand read it in his car driving home from the airport. He had flown to Chicago in a last attempt to hold a national advertiser who had refused to renew a $3 million contract. 2 days of skillful effort had failed. Winand lost the advertiser. Stepping off the plane in Newark, he picked up the New York papers.
His car was waiting to take him to his country house. Then he read One Small Voice. He wondered for a moment what paper he held. He looked at the name on the top of the page. But it was the banner, and the column was there in its proper place. Column 1, first page, second section. He leaned forward and told the chauffeur to drive to his office. He sat with the page spread open on his lap until the car stopped before the banner building. He noticed it at once when he entered the building, in the eyes of two reporters who emerged from an elevator in the lobby, in the pose of the elevator man who fought a desire to turn and stare back at him, in the sudden immobility of all the men in his anteroom, in the break of a typewriter's clicking on the desk of one secretary, in the lifted hand of another. He saw the waiting. Then he knew that all the implications of the unbelievable were understood by everyone on his paper. He felt a first dim shock, because the waiting around him contained wonder, and something was wrong if there could be any wonder in anyone's mind about the outcome of an issue between him and Ellsworth Toohey. But he had no time to take notice of his own reactions. He had no attention to spare for anything except a sense of tightness, a pressure against the bones of his face, his teeth, his cheeks, the bridge of his nose. And he knew he must press back against that, keep it down, hold it. He greeted no one and walked into his office. Alva Skerritt sat slumped in a chair before his desk. Skerritt had a bandage of soiled white gauze on his throat, and his cheeks were flushed. Wynand stopped in the middle of the room. The people outside had felt relieved. Wynand's face looked calm. Alva Skerritt knew better.
"Gail, I wasn't here,"
he gulped in a cracked whisper that was not a voice at all.
"I haven't been here for 2 days. Laryngitis, Gail. Ask my doctor. I wasn't here. I just got out of bed. Look at me. I've got 103 fever. I mean, the doctor didn't want me to, but to get up, I mean. Gail, I wasn't here. I wasn't here."
He could not be certain that Wynand heard, but Wynand let him finish, then assumed the appearance of listening, as if the sounds were reaching him, delayed. After a moment, Wynand asked, "Who was on the copy desk?"
It went through Allen and Falk.
Fire Harding, Allen, Falk, and Toohey. Buy off Harding's contract, but not Toohey's. Have them all out of the building in 15 minutes. Harding was the managing editor, Falk, a copy reader, Allen, the slot man, head of the copy desk. All had worked on the banner for more than 10 years. It was as if Skerritt had heard a news flash announcing the impeachment of a president, the destruction of New York City by a meteor, and the sinking of California into the Pacific Ocean.
"Gail!"
he screamed.
"We can't!"
"Get out of here." Skerritt got out. Wynand pressed a switch on his desk and said in answer to the trembling voice of the woman outside, "Don't admit anyone."
"Yes, Mr. Wynand."
He pressed a button and spoke to the circulation manager. "Stop every copy on the street." "Mr. Wynand, it's too late. Most of them are..." "Stop them." "Yes, Mr. Wynand." He wanted to put his head down on the desk, lie still, and rest. Only the form of rest he needed did not exist, greater than sleep, greater than death, the rest of having never lived. The wish was like a secret taunt against himself, because he knew that the splitting pressure in his skull meant the opposite, an urge to action, so strong that he felt paralyzed. He fumbled for some sheets of clean paper, forgetting where he kept them. He had to write the editorial that would explain and counteract. He had to hurry. He felt no right to any minute that passed with the thing unwritten. The pressure disappeared with the first word he put on paper. He thought, while his hand moved rapidly, what a power there was in words. Later, for those who heard them, but first, for the one who found them, a healing power, a solution, like the breaking of a barrier. He thought, perhaps the basic secret the scientists have never discovered, the first fount of life, is that which happens when a thought takes shape in words. He heard the rumble, the vibration in the walls of his office, in the floor. The presses were running off his afternoon paper, a small tabloid, the Clarion. He smiled at the sound, His hand went faster, as if the sound were energy pumped into his fingers. He had dropped his usual editorial "we." He wrote, "And if my readers or my enemies wish to laugh at me over this incident, I shall accept it and consider it the payment of a debt incurred. I have deserved it." He thought, "It's the heart of this building, beating. What time is it? Do I really hear it, or is it my own heart? Once a doctor put the ends of his stethoscope to my ears and let me hear my own heartbeats. It sounded just like this. He said I was a healthy animal and good for many years. For many years. I have foisted upon my readers a contemptible blackguard whose spiritual stature is my only excuse. I had now reached a degree of contempt for society such as would have permitted me to consider him dangerous. I am still holding on to a respect for my fellow men, sufficient to let me say that Ellsworth Toohey cannot be a menace." They say sound never dies but travels on in space. What happens to a man's heartbeats? So many of them in 56 years. Could they be gathered again in some sort of condenser and put to use once more? If they were rebroadcast, would the result be the beating of those presses? But I have sponsored him under the masthead of my paper, and if public penance is a strange, humiliating act to perform in our modern age, such is the punishment I impose upon myself hereby. Not 56 years of those soft little drops of sound a man never hears, each single and final, not like a comma, but like a period, a long string of periods on a page gathered to feed those presses. Not 56, but 31. The other 25 went to make me ready. I was 25 when I raised the new masthead over the door. Publishers don't change the name of a paper. This one does. The New York Banner. Gail Winans' Banner. I ask the forgiveness of every man who has ever read this paper. A healthy animal, and that which comes from me is healthy. I must bring that doctor here and have him listen to those presses. He'll grin in his good, smug, satisfied way. Doctors like a specimen of perfect health occasionally. It's rare enough. I must give him a treat. The healthiest sound he ever heard. And he'll say the Banner is good for many years. The door of his office opened, and Ellsworth Toohey came in. Winand let him cross the room and approach the desk, without a gesture of protest. Winand thought that what he felt was curiosity, if curiosity could be blown into the dimensions of a thing from the abyss, like those drawings of beetles the size of a house advancing upon human figures in the pages of the Banner's Sunday supplement. Curiosity, because Ellsworth Toohey was still in the building. Because Toohey had gained admittance past the orders given. And because Toohey was laughing.
"I came to take my leave of absence, Mr. Winand," said Toohey.
His face was composed. It expressed no gloating. The face of an artist who knew that overdoing was defeat and achieved the supreme of offensiveness by remaining normal.
"And to tell you that I'll be back. On this job. On this column. In this building.
In the interval, you will have seen the nature of the mistake you've made.
Do forgive me, I know this is in utterly bad taste, but I've waited for it for 13 years, and I think I can permit myself 5 minutes as a reward. So, you were a possessive man, Mr. Winand, and you loved your sense of property. Did you ever stop to think what it rested upon? Did you stop to secure the foundations? No, because you were a practical man. Practical men deal in bank accounts, real estate, advertising contracts, and gilt-edged securities. They leave to the impractical intellectuals, like me, the amusements of putting the gilt edges through a chemical analysis to learn a few things about the nature and the source of gold. They hang on to cremo pudding, and leave us such trivia as the theater, the movies, the radio, the schools, the book reviews, and the criticism of architecture. Just a sop to keep us quiet if we care to waste our time playing with the inconsequentials of life while you're making money. Money is power. Is it, Mr. Winand? So you were after power, Mr. Winand? Power over men? You poor amateur. You never discovered the nature of your own ambition, or you'd have known that you weren't fit for it. You couldn't use the methods required, and you wouldn't want the results.
You've never been enough of a scoundrel. I don't mind handing you that because I don't know which is worse, to be a great scoundrel or a gigantic fool. That's why I'll be back. And when I am, I'll run this paper.
Wynand said quietly,
When you are. Now get out of here.
The city room of the Banner walked out on strike. The Union of Wynand employees walked out in a body. A great many others, non-members, joined them. The typographical staff remained. Wynand had never given a thought to the union. He paid higher wages than any other publisher, and no economic demands had ever been made upon him. If his employees wished to amuse themselves by listening to speeches, he saw no reason to worry about it. Dominique had tried to warn him once. Gale, if people want to organize for wages, hours, or practical demands, it's their proper right. But when there's no tangible purpose, you'd better watch closely.
Darling, how many times do I have to ask you? Keep off the Banner.
He had never taken the trouble to learn who belonged to the union. He found now that the membership was small and crucial. It included all his key men, not the big executives, but the rank below, expertly chosen, the active ones, the small indispensable spark plugs, the best leg men, the general assignment men, the rewrite men, the assistant editors. He looked up their records. Most of them had been hired in the last 8 years, recommended by Mr. Toohey. Non-members walked out for various reasons, some because they hated Wynand, others because they were afraid to remain, and it seemed easier than to analyze the issue. One man, a timid little fellow, met Wynand in the hall and stopped to shriek,
"We'll be back, sweetheart, and then it will be a different tune."
Some left, avoiding the sight of Wynand. Others played safe. "Mr. Wynand, I hate to do it. I hate it like hell. I had nothing to do with that union, but a strike's a strike, and I can't permit myself to be a scab. Honest, Mr. Wynand, I don't know who's right or wrong. I do think Ellsworth pulled a dirty trick, and Harding had no business letting him get away with it, but how can one be sure who's right about anything nowadays? And one thing I won't do is I won't cross a picket line, no sir. The way I feel is, picket's right or wrong." The strikers presented two demands. The reinstatement of the four men who had been discharged. A reversal of the Banner's stand on the Cortland case. Harding, the managing editor, wrote an article explaining his position. It was published in the New Frontiers. "I did ignore Mr. Wynand's orders in a matter of policy, perhaps an unprecedented action for a managing editor to take. I did so with full realization of the responsibility involved. Mr. Toohey, Allen, Falk, and I wished to save the Banner for the sake of its employees, its stockholders, and its readers. We wished to bring Mr. Wynand to reason by peaceful means. We hoped he would give in with good grace once he had seen the Banner committed to the stand shared by most of the press of the country. We knew the arbitrary, unpredictable, and unscrupulous character of our employer, but we took the chance, willing to sacrifice ourselves to our professional duty. While we recognize an owner's right to dictate the policy of his paper on political, sociological, or economic issues, we believe that a situation has gone past the limits of decency when an employer expects self-respecting men to espouse the cause of a common criminal. We wish Mr. Wynand to realize that the day of dictatorial one-man rule is past. We must have some say in the running of the place where we make our living. It is a fight for the freedom of the press." Mr. Harding was 60 years old, owned an estate on Long Island, and divided his spare time between skeet shooting and breeding pheasants. His childless wife was a member of the board of directors of the Workshop for Social Study. Toohey, its star lecturer, had introduced her to the workshop. She had written her husband's article. The two men off the copy desk were not members of Toohey's union. Allen's daughter was a beautiful young actress, starred in all of Ike's plays. Falk's brother was secretary to Lancelot Clokey. Gale Wynand sat at the desk in his office and looked down at a pile of paper. He had many things to do. But one picture kept coming back to him, and he could not get rid of it, and the sense of it clung to all his actions. The picture of a ragged boy standing before the desk of an editor. "Can you spell cat? Can you spell anthropomorphology?" The identities cracked and became mixed. It seemed to him that the boy stood here at his desk, waiting, and once he said aloud, "Go away." He caught himself in anger. He thought, "You're cracking, you fool, now's not the time." He did not speak aloud again, but the conversation went on silently while he read, checked, and signed papers. "Go away, we have no jobs here. I'll hang around. Use me when you want to. You don't have to pay me." "They're paying you, don't you understand, you little fool? They're paying you." Aloud, his voice normal, he said into a telephone, "Tell Manning that we'll have to fill in with Matt stuff. Send up the proofs as soon as you can. Send up a sandwich. Any kind." A few had remained with him. The old men and the copy boys. They came in the morning, often with cuts on their faces and blood on their collars. One stumbled in, his skull open, and had to be sent away in an ambulance. It was neither courage nor loyalty. It was inertia. They had lived too long with the thought that the world would end if they lost their jobs on the banner. The old ones did not understand. The young ones did not care. Copy boys were sent out on reporters' beats. Most of the stuff they sent in was of such quality that Wynand was forced past despair into howls of laughter. He had never read such highbrow English. He could see the pride of the ambitious youth who was a journalist at last. He did not laugh when the stories appeared in the banner as written. There were not enough rewrite men. He tried to hire new men. He offered extravagant salaries. The people he wanted refused to work for him. A few men answered his call, and he wished they hadn't, though he hired them. They were men who had not been employed by a reputable newspaper for 10 years, the kind who would not have been allowed a month ago into the lobby of his building. Some of them had to be thrown out in 2 days. Others remained. They were drunk most of the time. Some acted as if they were granting Wynand a favor. "Don't you get huffy, Gale, old boy," said one, and was tossed bodily down 2 flights of stairs. He broke an ankle and sat on the bottom landing, looking up at Wynand with an air of complete astonishment. Others were subtler. They merely stalked about and looked at Wynand slyly, almost winking, implying that they were fellow criminals tied together in a dirty deal. He appealed to schools of journalism. No one responded. One student body sent him a resolution signed by all its members. "Entering our careers with a high regard for the dignity of our profession, dedicating ourselves to uphold the honor of the press, we feel that none among us could preserve his self-respect and accept an offer such as yours." The news editor had remained at his desk. The city editor had gone. Wynand filled in as city editor, managing editor, wire man, rewrite man, copy boy. He did not leave his building. He slept on a couch in his office, as he had done in the first years of the banner's existence. Coatless, tieless, his shirt collar torn open, he ran up and down the stairs, his steps like the rattle of a machine gun. 2 elevator boys had remained, the others had vanished. No one knew just when or why, whether prompted by sympathy for the strike, fear, or plain discouragement. Alva Skerritt could not understand Wynand's calm. The brilliant machine, and that thought Skerritt was really the word which had always stood for Wynand in his mind, had never functioned better. His words were brief, his orders rapid, his decisions immediate. In the confusion of machines, lead, grease, ink, waste paper, unswept offices, untenanted desks, glass crashing in sudden showers when a brick was hurled from the street below, Wynand moved like a